This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. People from smart cities around the world are converging on Charlotte this week in an attempt to get smarter. Why, Charlotte? Because we are the site for the quarterly meeting of the Smart Cities Council. And we are the site because Charlotte is quickly rising to the top of a list of cities around the world designated as smart cities. So what constitutes a smart city? We'll spend the hour finding that out. We're joined by the founder and chairman of the Smart Cities Council, Jesse Burst. He launched that organization after years of being a technology analyst and featured columnist at magazines like Computer World and PC Week, and launching very successful internet technology websites. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Mike.
Nice to have you here. Bram Sieben is a consultant for Alliander in the Amsterdam Smart Cities program. That's Amsterdam in the Netherlands, in Holland. Is that right, Holland?
It is, yes.
In just 5 years, Amsterdam has started 75 smart city projects and ranks second in the European Smart Cities rankings. You're a long way from home. Welcome to Charlotte.
Thanks. Nice. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Philip Meese is president and CEO of Itron in Spokane, Washington. They are a hardware and software company concentrating on the energy and water sector, which is a major component of smart city development. Thank you for being here.
Yeah, nice to be here, Mike.
And welcome back to Charlotte's Mayor Dan Klotfelter, who is helping to host sustainability leaders from around the world during this Smart Cities Council Forum. So you're running again, Mr. Mayor.
I thought we were talking about smart cities.
Stole my joke. Welcome back.
Good to be back.
We'll start with you, Jesse Burst. What exactly is a smart city?
At its simplest, most essential, it's simply applying digital technology to improve urban life. So that's it. The same technologies that are revolutionizing every other aspect of our life are now being turned to improving city conditions.
And if you could start from scratch and build a city from a blank slate, mm-hmm. what would it look like if it were a true smart city in every aspect?
Well, I'll start with the essential components. There's three. First, you've got to have sensors around your city. So no longer do you wonder what the conditions are in your city. Your city tells you. So your streets tell you if they're congested.
Tells you what? What do they tell you?
Your buildings tell you if they're occupied, what their air quality is, how much energy they're using, and so on. For all the other assets.
That's a lot of data.
It is. It's a monstrous amount of data.
How do you get your arms around it?
Well, first you've got to have a communications network to carry that back and forth, and then you have computers, that's the third component, that crunch that data and create the real value which comes from analyzing all that data.
In Charlotte, may I suggest we start with traffic flow, that we start with synchronizing the traffic signals? Can we do that?
That is being done now.
It's being done now.
Using an older generation of technologies, if you notice that we do go out and capture data about traffic flows, but it's with the old mechanical technology where they put the lines across the road and you count and then you take it back to the office and you try to analyze what's done there. What the smart city concept would do would embed those sensors in the pavement. And we're doing some of that now, so you're capturing it in real time constantly. And we're beginning to move in that direction with our traffic management, especially in the center of the city. Mm. One of the more interesting things, you think about it in a smart city approach to transportation, we've had a lot of debate locally about the so-called managed lane on Interstate 77 North. Mm-hmm. But that depends upon smart technology to capture the traffic flows and to manage the pricing of the tolls on that lane based upon the traffic flows. And that's a use of smart technology in order to manage that lane to preserve a consistent transportation usage.
Mike, in cities like Singapore and Dallas, they send their emergency crews where the accident will happen. That's how accurate they're able to predict stuff. They send their taxis where they will be needed. They can predict with about 90% accuracy where congestion will occur and take steps to alleviate it, change their HOV lane pricing or change a one-way lane and so on.
And how long have they been able to do that?
It's probably been about 2 or 3 years they've been doing that in Singapore, and Dallas just started up about a year ago.
Where is the United States in comparison to the rest of the world in being able to do this?
Just beginning to catch on. So this is a year.
Why are we so slow with everything?
I'm going to turn to the politician to answer that. But
he's not the president yet.
to give you an example, on September 14 through 17 in Washington, D.C., we'll be holding America's first major smart cities expo and conference called the Smart Cities Week. In November, Barcelona will be holding its sixth. Singapore also will be holding its sixth. So we're a few years behind, but we're starting to catch on.
You, as I understand it, you are the founder of the Smart Cities Council. This is a worldwide organization.
It is.
When did you decide the time was right to establish this, and then how did you get cities across the world to get on board? There are 75 of these cities in Amsterdam.
That's right. Well, actually, it came from conversations with companies like Itron, which is one of our founding members. So forward-thinking technology companies who are seeing where the puck is going to be mm-hmm. and are already skating that direction. And we got several of them together and said, we need to do something to help cities. Educate them so they can become informed buyers and get on board. Because, the thing is, Mike, every city is competing with every other city for jobs and for talent. The younger generations, they decide where they want to live first, and then they decide, mm-hmm. What they're going to do there. And many of them can live anywhere because they're working with their computer.
So how many cities are on board?
Around the world, I think there's probably about maybe 600 cities.
And how long did it take to get that many? When did you start?
Well, our organization's just about 3 years old.
Wow.
But the Smart Cities movement has been going on for, gosh, 6-7 years. We started, thinking about it and talking about it in those terms. And part of that terms is not just having a smart grid or smart traffic, but integrating these things, doing cross-cutting initiatives so you can be sharing costs and sharing data.
What is driving the interest in this? What makes a city want to join your organization or do the things it has to do to become a smart city?
Happier for less. So you can spend less money and make your citizens happier. So, for instance, in Toronto, they started, instead of paying by check to their public benefits recipients, they started giving them a digital card, a cash card, essentially. They save $2 million a year, but they're also doing great things for the disadvantaged because they don't have the stigma. They don't have to walk around with cash. They don't have to go to a check payday cashing place and give 10% of just to get the cash. So now they're part of the digital economy, even if they're homeless or unbanked. Mm-hmm. And they're in every department of the city, there's ways to spend less and make your citizens happier by, for instance, delivering their citizen services right on their smartphone.
See, I thought this was going to be a conversation about energy and about water, because energy is saving energy and being efficient with energy and with water usage seems to be a major part of this, but you haven't mentioned that yet at all.
It's core. It's essential. And it's one of the things Charlotte's doing very good at, by the way. They're partnered with Itron and other companies with what Itron calls, resourcefulness, managing your precious resources, water, power, gas, et cetera, waste, more efficiently and effectively.
We're doing this, Philip Meese?
Yes, we are. And to your point, electricity and I would say gas and water are critical for livability in cities, controlling costs. And frequently, it's the projects that are going out to put out smart electric and water meters that form the backbone of a smart cities project, because we're able to build a communications network that then enables all of these additional sensors that Jesse has already talked about.
Now, we do have these buildings in the uptown core that evidently monitor what's going on with energy use. And maybe do the buildings speak to each other, or do they just speak to the electric company?
They do speak to the electric company. That's what you're describing as part of the Envision Charlotte initiative that was kicked off about a little more than a year ago. Mm-hmm. And it started in the downtown core because that's where we have the greatest density of mm-hmm. opportunity and also sort of resources and organizations to pull together a comprehensive program. But they've been able to enroll about 60 of the larger commercial properties in downtown and focus on audits, on real-time feedback, so changing behavior of the occupants of the office building in the ways they use energy, the ways they use water, and as a result of that, achieve some amazing reductions in total energy consumption in the downtown core in the last 12 months.
Really?
Yeah.
How much?
They've been able to measure that. That's one of the keys is you're measuring as you go, so you're getting real feedback about what your activities are producing. Mm-hmm. They've been able to reduce the energy consumption in that group of 60 buildings by 8.4% in the very short time they've been operating. That's a that translates into about a $10 million savings in electric electricity costs.
How difficult would it be to extrapolate that out to the suburbs?
Well, it's going to be different. I mean, again, because you have a high concentration in the center city, but we're still learning lessons about that. I think the next concept is to take that to water usage and then to waste generation and waste disposal, and then to take the lessons from that and begin to move it across the whole city.
Prior to being mayor, you were a state senator, so I'm just curious from that perspective, where other major cities in North Carolina stand with being smart cities? Is Raleigh a smart city?
I'm not as familiar with the local efforts, Mike, of the other cities. Right now, Charlotte's my focus, so that's where we're going to put our energy.
Well, is that why? Is there a particular reason why the Smart Cities Council Forum is taking place in Charlotte?
Yeah, because Charlotte really is a world leader, and I think an overlooked aspect.
That surprises me. I would think that would surprise a lot of our listeners. In what way are we a world leader?
This overlooked and underappreciated aspect, which is the kind of people side of things. You need to get all your stakeholders involved right from the beginning, business, utilities, community, citizen advocates, and so on, and bring them along and plan with them. And that's what they've done with Envision Charlotte. It's great public-private partnership.
Now, we are seeing in Charlotte something that's actually happening around the country, and that is this move toward the urban core. People want to come back and live in urban environments. And you told, Jesse Burst, you told Verge that 5 million people move to cities every month, and cities generate 70 to 80% of all carbon emissions while producing 75% of global gross domestic product. And you called this the greatest economic shift in history. Big words. Is it only sustainable through efforts like what you're promoting with smart cities?
When you think about it, when you think that more than half of all of us live in cities now, and soon that will be 60% and then 70%, we can't fix the planet unless we fix our cities. That's where people are moving to. That's where they're concentrated. So that's got to be job one.
Wow. Is it easier to create a smart city in a smaller area, or is it just as easy to do this in a Manhattan or Chicago or London?
Well, that's a tough question, and it varies so much. But the great thing about cities as opposed to, let's say, federal governments is that they can get things done. So they're big enough to have some economies of scale, and they're small enough to be able to get things done.
Now, the mayor's chuckling at that. I'm not sure what you're laughing at. Are you laughing at how difficult it is to get things done here, or are you laughing at the federal government?
When the truth is spoken, it always is interesting.
Is there pushback?
Pushback from?
To doing this here from either business or the political sector or individual citizens?
Well, I don't think you're going to get pushback so much until you start talking cost. And if there is pushback, that's where it'll come. Because a lot of what we'll have to do is retrofit systems that we already have in place. And that's going to have some costs associated with it. So far, we've been able to manage with voluntary cooperation, voluntary participation. And we hope to sort of use that model as far as we can.
Does the savings offset the cost?
It does in many cases. And, you know, the mayor just talked about the Envision Charlotte's achieved an 8.4% reduction. The target is 20%.
Right.
And the team feels that that's an absolutely achievable goal. One of the statistics that we talk about is 30% of water that's put into the system is wasted. There are huge opportunities for water conservation that will fund a number of these projects as well.
Philip Meese is president and CEO of ITROM, one of the Smart Cities partners. We're here with Jesse Burst with Smart Cities and Dan Klotfelter, the mayor, and we'll talk to Bram Sieben in a moment or two. He's from Amsterdam. Don't want him to sit here and waste his time. We're coming right back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Bradley Arant Bolt Cummings, LLP, a full-service law firm whose lawyers are industry professionals experienced in serving the banking and financial services industry in Charlotte and throughout the nation. Details at babc.com. You may have noticed that kids take to technology when given the opportunity, kind of like ducks to water. They seem to have an intuitive relationship with computers and tablets and things like that. And more kids are moving from simply playing games to actually writing computer code, building websites, repairing and maintaining their computers, and probably yours. In fact, they're teaching themselves to do all this, but that does not mean that schools shouldn't be teaching this. And tomorrow we meet some experts who are saying that the importance of computer science classes in schools cannot be overstated. We'll talk to them about why that is tomorrow at 9.
On the next Ian Rehm Show, the Supreme Court hears a case about a Texas group's request to use Confederate flag license plates, legal arguments in the free speech challenge, and the implications for other states.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about smart cities, well, of which Charlotte evidently is one because the Smart Cities Council is holding their quarterly forum here. Jesse Burst is the founder and chairman of that organization. Philip Measy is one of their partners. He's the president and CEO of Itron. That's a software and hardware company, which we'll talk more about in the coming hour. Dan Klodfelter is the mayor of Charlotte, and Bram Sieben is a consultant with Alliander. They are what is Alliander? Tell me what they are.
Alliander is a Dutch utility.
So it's like the electric company.
Electric and gas infrastructure.
You run the grid for a good part of the Netherlands.
About one third of the Netherlands, yes.
That's a big area. Tell me, how big is Amsterdam?
Amsterdam is around 850,000 people.
How big is Charlotte?
It's about 800,000.
So we're similar in size. And you have how many? 75 smart cities projects going on in Amsterdam?
Yeah, we're already active for about 5 years. I think the smart city program is looks a lot like the Envision Charlotte program. So I was very fond of the program, how it's set up here. Mm-hmm. But there's a slight difference, I think, is that I'm actually working for Alliander in the smart city program. So I have more or less 10 colleagues from different companies, mm-hmm. who are also working for their own company in the Smart City program. So collectively, we're a group, we're colleagues and whatsoever, but we're all working for our individual companies and taking the network, the knowledge, the expertise, and everything that comes with it into the Smart City program to set up new projects, set up new collaborations, and define new concepts.
So what kinds of things are you doing collectively?
Collectively, we're looking at, for example, smart city logistics or clean city logistics. So looking at trying to see whether you can actually provide the city or provide the goods within the city, the chilled goods, on a different way, in a different manner. So
explain that. Chilled goods? Is that what you just said?
Yeah, I'm just sorry.
That's it. What does that mean?
Is it? So I mean like all the supplies for all the cafes, bars,
so
whatsoever.
Food.
Yeah,
food delivery.
Sorry.
Okay, that's okay.
So it's food delivery. But then, because now it's done by trucks, it's similar as here. So there's a lot of trucks pumping around the gas and the gasoline and whatsoever. So try to see how you can actually cooperate, because there are so many different suppliers within the city. Try to see how you can actually collectively find an approach include electric mobility in there. But you have to have the charging poles, you have to have the smart parking spots as well. So there's a lot of infrastructure. So I agree with Jesse. There's a lot of technology needed there, but there's also another level of collaboration. So you need the technology, you need the investment, you need the infrastructure. And I think it's happier for less, but it's also sharing for less.
How many companies are driving electric trucks that need to be charged, and how many individuals in that part of the world are driving electric cars? Because one of the problems with electric car, the establishment of any kind of electric car, is to build the infrastructure to allow people to have those cars charged and not be stranded when they run out of batteries. How do you find the point where that pays for itself, where it makes sense to put in the infrastructure because there's enough of a demand for it?
I think it starts with actively working with the concept and then collaborating together they're involved, like the five biggest suppliers over now. So get them involved, get them aligned with the same thinking, get them actually working together on the concept, agreeing on going further. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of process before you actually start implementing, and also, of course, determining the business case of the concept.
So how many charging stations do you have throughout Amsterdam, how big is the demand? I'm just curious, because electric vehicles are not really, there's not a plethora of them on the road yet.
No, well, there are in the Netherlands. I think
there
the Netherlands.
Are.
Yeah, it's
who makes these cars?
That's what $8 gas will do for you.
Yes. who makes these cars?
Well, so there's a cost definition there as well. No, we have Tesla. We have the Nissan Leaf. We have different kinds of electric cars. Charging poles. We have there's about 1,000 now in Amsterdam only, and they're looking to expand in the next 3 to 4 years to 4,000 charging poles.
Wow.
You know, the last time I flew into Amsterdam, which was a couple months ago, when I looked for a taxi, there was a line of Teslas there, Tesla taxis.
A taxi driver can afford a Tesla?
In Amsterdam, apparently.
Yeah.
I'm going to become a taxi driver in Amsterdam.
Well, there's a great example of taxi electric, only driving around with electric cabs. I just want to point out one other thing. I think because in Amsterdam, the sharing economy is also becoming growing. And there's, for example, there's a very a very fun initiative as well. If I leave Amsterdam or if I fly out of Schiphol, that's the airport, mm-hmm. I can actually rent out my car. So my car will be shared for the whole time that I will be away. It's fully insured and everything. Once I come back, it's clean, it's washed and everything, and it stands right in front of the airport and I can leave again.
Wow.
So those type of concepts, I think, are very useful for a smart city as well. It needs a little bit of technology as well,
uh-huh.
but at least it needs a social groundwork. It needs a lot of people and citizens involved.
I guess you could compare it to Uber in a way, because you're trusting Uber to pick you up as a taxi service, even though they're not a taxi service. They're individual cars driven by individual owners. But the social part of that and other things like that in a smart cities concept seems to me to be something that would be more difficult to implement than some of the things that we'll talk to Philip Meese about with regard to ITRON and monitoring water and electricity usage, because this requires an element of trust and a shift in social behavior. How difficult has that been in Holland?
Well, I think it's the sharing economy is growing very fast in Holland as well. Trust is of course it's a big a big variable in it. But trust is growing. I think the physical space is becoming more important in there as well. So there's a lot of trust in people actually knowing where he's from, what he does and everything. So you can tap into the existing networks. And the existing networks that are already there on sports level, hobbies, whatsoever, they all have the trust element in there already.
So you're here and you've been here for a couple of days. Is your car being rented right now?
Nope.
No. Have you done it before?
No, my wife has my car now.
Okay.
So.
All right. I won't pursue that.
I have it.
We have a question out there for Facebook and Twitter and email, folks. What smart method do you see in other cities that you'd like Charlotte to adopt? And what do you think Charlotte is doing right as it becomes a smart city? If you know, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at WFAE. What exactly does your organization, Jesse Burst, what does it do for these other cities around the world?
We're trying to help collect all the best practices. Our members collectively, our advisors plus our members, have 1.4 million employees. They have 2.4 trillion in annual revenues. They've worked on more than 5,000 smart city projects around the world in the last 5 years. We're collecting those lessons learned, those best practices, and passing them on to cities.
And as I understand it, you have quarterly meetings, and you're having your quarterly meeting here yesterday and today. And do attendees come to particular areas to see what those areas are doing in a search for best practices?
Yes, and to trade ideas with their peers, to learn from the technology companies. We also distribute our materials on our website. We have a Smart Cities Readiness Guide, 27 foundational principles for a smart city. I always tell city leaders, at least make some new mistakes. Don't make the same mistakes all these pioneers have done. It's right here in the readiness guide. Study it.
I think I can ask you this, Dan Clodfelter, because you've only been the mayor for a short time. Because Jesse Burst has said that Charlotte is an inspiration for many cities in the smart cities area. Why and who's responsible?
Well, I'm not sure you could assign it to any one group or one person, but I think there was a sort of a collective view among the leadership in the business community and the nonprofit sector that we really need to think about ways to stay competitive, to stay ahead of the game, to try to take the assets that we've got today and redeploy them in a way that's going to be most competitive in the 21st century. And the smart city concept seemed to fit that model. I will say this, though. I have to call out one of our corporate citizens, Duke Energy, who was really an early adopter of this kind of concept. And they helped convene, they helped the city convene a lot of the partners who have come to the table to put together, for example, Envision Charlotte. So we did have a key leadership role there played by Duke and a lot of other partners in the community.
You've also said, Jesse, that we chose Charlotte based on its success as an innovation hub and a model of partnership and collaboration. The idea that we are an innovation hub might be a surprise to a lot of our listeners. In what way are we an innovation hub?
Well, you're becoming a high-tech center. It's a great place to live. You've got the infrastructure, the high-tech infrastructure. You know, the highways of today are broadband highways. And just as you needed to be on a railroad and then you needed to be on the interstate, now you need to be on the broadband highway. And if you really want to get some examples, just go to UNC Charlotte and talk to some of these kids. In fact, a day or two from now, they're having a symposium on urban data and visualization. So how do you take all the data that's pouring in and make it accessible to humans, mere humans, to understand what's going on and take action?
You mentioned broadband, so let's bring up Google. Google is coming. Google Fiber is coming. We don't know exactly when they're rolling it out or when it will be up to speed, but it promises speeds 100 times faster than what is commonly available here now. And I know that in other parts of the world, I'm not sure how fast the internet speeds are in Amsterdam, but other parts of the world, they are considerably faster and considerably less expensive. What are the top speeds in Amsterdam, for instance?
In one area, there's about 500 megabits.
So. Okay. So that's half the speed of what Google will bring to Charlotte. They're bringing a gigabit. But that's faster than what we have now. Why is that important? Explain, and maybe Itron. We should bring Itron because you deal with this on a regular basis. Why is that important?
Sure. I mean, the digital economy is going to be enabled by pervasive communication networks. And so we need this kind of high-speed backbone in order to collect all of this digital and sensor-based information that Jesse has talked about.
Because one of the things that Google, we had a conversation about this last week on the program. Google was here. They have a different business model than most of the other internet service providers. That's not meant to be a criticism. It's just a fact. And the other providers could provide, if they wanted to build out the infrastructure to the extent that Google is going to build it out with fiber, they could provide the gigabyte per second. And in many markets where Google has entered, they are now doing that. The AT&Ts and the cable companies are now doing that. But if it's so important and there is money to be made as a result, why aren't they doing it now?
I think we better turn to the politician.
I'm not sure I can even begin to approach
Well, you spent your career up to this point writing for computer magazines.
I really think it's just some cities don't understand the 21st century economy. They don't understand they're competing with every other city.
But what about the companies that provide this? Is it that they don't see the demand, therefore they can't put out the expense? Is that what's going on?
No, I think it's just an ROI discussion. You know, they're going to postpone the investment as long as they can and make it when they see a return on investment. And, you know, thank God for a free market where you can get competitors to come in and push each other. And that's what's been needed is more competition in the local market so they'll push each other.
Yeah, because we have no competition in that area. It's usually tied up by one or two companies,
right.
And they don't really compete.
Mike, you're on to a topic I think that really is important in the smart city concept, which is thinking ahead and kind of planning. Dig the trench once.
Yes. Right.
Think about all the things that need to go in it. One of the impediments to these kinds of investments that you're talking about is that these companies have to come in and build infrastructure one trench at a time, one wire at a time. And what we're really talking about with smart cities is taking a crosscut through the city, understanding what the needs are across a variety of different departments, and then making sure that the investments that we make really apply to solve many of the potential problems that are out there so that we build this infrastructure. And what we're doing at Itron is really trying to move to an open standards-based approach that allows us to make sure that as we deploy smart sensors in the field – and put communications networks over them, that we can make that investment once, and then that network is then available for many other purposes throughout the rest of the city.
That's one of the things that the representative from Google mentioned off the air after our conversation last week was this dig the trench once approach. Is Charlotte taking that? Because this is going to be, when they come in, somewhat disruptive for a while they put these fiber optic cables in. But their point is, if you have to dig up a water main, if you start putting down little pieces of the trench, then everybody can use that conduit to put their cables.
Mike, that's been longstanding city policy when we're doing major infrastructure extensions, is to go in and do everything once. If we're building the blue line extension out to the university, we also want to at the same time go in and upgrade whatever utility conduits or systems we have along that same corridor. So that concept is already embedded in the organization. We'll just be applying it now to a new technology or a new type of infrastructure.
Charlotte's one of the first cities in the world to have developed that program to measure energy usage in those downtown buildings that we spoke of a little while ago. What infrastructure supports the transfer of all that data to a central point for analysis? So do we already have in the downtown core a faster, better, broader pipeline for that sort of
thing? We have pieces of it, but again, what we want is that to be ubiquitous across the entire city. Mm-hmm. It's not just enough to have a piece here and a piece there. As I think our experts have said to us, is it's got to be integrated. It's got to be available across different types of users so that they can trade data with each other. And I think that's really one of the powerful things about getting this kind of open standard platform that we were just talking about just a minute ago, is that we'll be able to have our electricity usage, our water usage, our gas usage, all of that sort of shared so that a business or an individual can acquire that data in a package and sort of look at it all as an entire package.
Talk about this open standard platform. What does that mean? Are you talking about a common language that any computer program written to analyze data can understand?
Well, the goal is to make it as easy to put devices out in the field as it is for you to open a PC or a tablet and have it instantly connect to the Internet. And for those people who remember when you plugged in your computer, that there is a standard plug and there is an easy way for these devices to communicate. And so the history of our industry has been that individual suppliers have built proprietary systems and essentially locked that innovation into a particular project. And what we're trying to move towards is a world in which the devices can identify themselves to the network and the data is described in a public format to make it possible for the mayor's vision to be realized.
I only have a minute left in this segment, but have these systems been proprietary because there's an economic advantage to them being proprietary, or have they been proprietary simply because Company A designs for Company B and Company C designs for Company D because that's who the contract was with?
Yeah, it's really been market dynamics and companies like ours trying to gain advantage. Our new advantage is to be a first mover and just to really drive innovation and openness. So it's a big change.
Does this open standards concept exist in Amsterdam?
It does, and they're actually trying to expand it as well, because it was more or less a little bit the same way, like Company A has this, Company B has this, whatsoever. So they're actually, for example, they're working on open smart grid protocols, which are also trying to – it's a huge collaboration. I think there's 29 – how many – there's a large number of companies and organizations involved. To collectively provide a platform that everyone can tap into, just as Philip just mentioned.
Bram Sieber is a consultant with Alliander and in the Amsterdam Smart Cities program. We're coming right back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Creative Loafing's Moo and Brew Craft Beer Burger and Music Festival, Saturday, April the 11th at the NC Music Factory Festival Grounds. Over 40 craft beers, Charlotte's Best Burger Competition, and live music by Langhorne Slim and The Law. Tickets at mooandbrew.com. The Supreme Court hears a case about Texas groups' request to use Confederate flag license plates. Legal arguments over the free speech challenge and implications for other states, the topic of the conversation in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show. And if you'd like to jump into our conversation about smart cities, you can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter. And we're coming right back.
Thank you. I'm WFAE General Manager Joe O'Connor. Thank you to the thousands of listeners who contributed during our spring membership campaign. Your investment turns into the best in global, national, and especially award-winning local journalism. If you didn't get a chance to give, you can, of course, still do so at WFAE.org. Thank you for supporting WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about smart cities, Charlotte being one of them, and Charlotte being the host of the Smart Cities Council Forum that Jesse Burst is the founder and chairman of. The mayor of Charlotte is here with us, Dan Clodfelter, as is Bram Sieben, a consultant with Alliander. They run the electric grid, but he's also in Amsterdam, but he's in a good part of the Netherlands. But he's also one of the coordinators of the Amsterdam Smart Cities Program. And Philip Meese is with us. He's the president and CEO of Itron. Your company has made meters, electric meters, water meters, gas meters, for measuring all this use and consumption for years. And now you've, as I understand it, you have moved into the software area of that measurement. And the key part of being a smart city, as we've talked about, is to measure this consumption as it occurs, real time, gathering real time data, and even control the use of it when necessary. Why is this important?
Well, the company's history has really been in using the meter as a cash register for the utility, which is what they mm-hmm. wanted. But what we've discovered when we make these devices smart is that they are, as you said, real-time sensors that are able to understand how and when customers are using electricity, gas, and water, and very importantly, how efficiently the distribution system is working. And that's important because I mentioned that a significant amount of water is lost, so that we have the opportunity to use the data to try to isolate where leaks occur in the system. And those leaks occur, you can easily understand water leaks, but there are gas leaks in the network, and a significant amount of electricity is wasted in distribution. And so this real-time data really allows the utilities to eliminate very significant amounts of waste. We estimate in North America about $39 billion a year are lost.
$39 billion?
In the distribution of electricity, gas, and water, yes.
And so how would real-time knowledge of its consumption help the companies save that money?
Well, I mean, the humble example in the case of water is that if there's a smart meter at your house and your water usage never goes to zero, it's pretty clear that there's a leak behind the meter of some kind. And those, you know, that simple example can be used in many different areas where you see anomalies in usage that, mm-hmm. that imply that there are malfunctions in the system.
And is there an upside benefit for consumers, ultimately, in the when we build this out, when it's up and running fully, when we're making the best use of broadband technology to monitor all this in real time, will there come a day when I get a notice on my smartphone, hey, charge your car now because there's plenty of electricity on the grid and it will be cheaper if you do it between now and 5:30 this afternoon?
Great example of really moving beyond diagnosing problems to detecting them in real time, to preventing them, to providing proactive alerts. And what we found from the research that's been done is that we can improve behavioral changes, which we've used in Envision Charlotte to get this first 8.4% reduction. We can then get to that 20% target by providing some level of automation and queuing and control that this technology provides.
Now,
can I give an example from the Netherlands as well? We're working on a program called Vehicle to Grid, where we actually start experimenting with demand response systems as well, where you can actually use your electric car as home storage as well. So you can not only load your vehicle, but you can also unload it to the grid or to your house when the price is right, for example. So that's the try to see when there's a lot of sun available, the electricity prices perhaps go lower. It's a fixed tariff, so it's a fixed price, but in the future, we think if you start varying prices, people will adjust not necessarily adjust or have their home storage available, or otherwise adjust their usage of uh-huh. the electricity when it's free available.
Let's come back to this home storage concept for just a second. You're saying that in addition to charging your car on the grid, there can be times when the car can give back to the grid. You can actually run your lights off the car in the house. Is that what you're saying?
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's what I'm saying, and I think therefore you also need a smart infrastructure to be able to recognize all the different flows, so the energy flows, but also the power quality of the electricity lines, for example.
So this is the Internet of Things. When we talk about the Internet of Things, this is really part of that. And the Nest thermostat, products like that are just the tiny, tiny, tiny beginnings of what we're talking about, right?
Absolutely. You know, to this discussion, I would just add that, yes, we're going to have these alerts, but they're not that often going to come to humans. Most of the time, it's going to be machines talking to other machines. So your car, it will be talking to your utility. That will say, charge now for the next hour and a half.
Skynet. So your to do what we're talking about here, particularly from your point of view at Itron, you've made meters, normal, regular, everyday average meters, dumb meters for years that people have to come out and read. Now you're making smart meters that can be interconnected with technology. But that means the meters have to be changed. It means they have to be interconnected on a some sort of a broadband grid. It means there have to be sensors and other things to deliver real-time information as it happens. How expensive is it to do all this? Where is that money going to come from in our tax-averse country? Where is that going to how is that going to happen?
Well, it's already happening. You know, the Duke Power is making significant investments in smart metering in its jurisdictions, and the city is reconsidering on the water side the investments that it's going to make in smart technology. You look at the significant expense. We look at the significant value that these projects generate, and we've seen tremendous success in large-scale implementations that we've done with this type of smart technology. So the investments are being made. What we're trying to ensure with the Smart Cities Project is, as these investments are being made, that we're dig the trench once, that these investments are made in an open-ended way in which we can leverage the infrastructure that's being put in place for many other types of devices that are going to go out on the Internet of Things.
And yesterday at a panel discussion, Bram, you were talking about how smarter energy creates smarter cities. Is that what we're talking about here with Philip, the fact that we'd have smarter meters and smarter monitoring, or is there something more to it than that?
I think there's more to this this topic. Definitely, so you have the smart infrastructure, for example, on the energy part, with the lightning, with the vehicle to grid, which I just mentioned, the open data stuff we already mentioned. But there's also another, I think, which is fascinating as well, is for example, a group of people are actually tapping in or trying to establish buying their own heat infrastructure network. From a residual heat from the, for example, a hospital nearby. And then people are becoming more, I think that's the prosumer, and the consumer who actually wants to become more self-sustainable, which becomes more self-sufficient and self-reliant, whatever. So you actually see a movement from the bottom up as well, which I think is very significant, which I think the value of it is very strong if you use it correctly and if you initiate the right collaboration between the top-down approach and the bottom-up initiatives. Yeah.
Bottom-up would be the consumer?
Bottom-up would be the consumer or cooperatives, so the collective consumers or, yeah.
And businesses, too.
And businesses, too, yeah.
They've really seen the business advantage. You know, if you want a cleaner environment, then you're in favor of a smart grid, whether you realize it or not, because you can't integrate renewables at large scale without a smart grid. Or if you want to be a more resilient city, so you recover from storms more quickly, then you're in favor of a smart grid because you can't get there without that.
And Philip, you have said that one of the challenges that we face in smart meter adoption, for instance, that that's your area of business expertise and enthusiasm, I guess, is we have to have consumer engagement. That means what?
That means making the data available that these smart devices are collecting to the consumer to give them the information that they need to make better decisions about how and when they're using electricity, gas, and water. That means going potentially a step further, as Jesse mentioned, where you're enabling machine-to-machine communication. The consumer can log on and say, I'm willing to reduce my thermostat. You gave the Nest example. I'm willing to have my thermostat adjusted on the hottest day of the year if electricity is prices are surging by a small amount that the consumer may not notice.
We already have that, I think, with Duke Energy and with some other electric companies where people voluntarily tell the power company that when there's a great deal of demand, you can turn off my air conditioner for 30 minutes or an hour or whatever it may be. How popular is that? I mean, people do benefit economically from that, and they also benefit in their minds in terms of making this a greener place, if that's important to them. But how popular are programs like that around the country? How many people are actually saying, it's 99 degrees outside, there's a great demand on the grid, go ahead, turn off my air conditioner for 30 minutes. Go ahead, do it.
I mean, many of these programs have been in place for 30 or 40 years. They have not been as effective as they could potentially be, and there is a much larger audience, and they could be potentially
not
very much more popular.
Because they're not being adopted or because people don't really want their air conditioning to go off when it's 99 degrees outside?
I mean, there are a variety.
Just asking.
Yeah, sure, the variety of reasons. And I understand your concern. You know, what we've found in research is most of the time by adjusting the thermostat by 1 to 2 degrees mm-hmm. for a short period of time, the consumer is actually unaware of the change. So it is really possible for these programs to get much broader.
Let me throw this out to everybody here sitting at the table. Why should consumers, why should businesses care about all of this? Jesse.
Sure. Your own self-advantage. So if you're a business, even a small to medium business, if there's a power outage, you're going to be losing $5,000, $10,000, $15,000, even a small business, because you can't do business. Your cash register doesn't work, et cetera, et cetera. If you're a citizen and you care about a clean environment, you want your kids to grow up in a green, healthy city, then you care about this. If you want your city to be a vibrant hub of great, you know, talented folks, they come to these kind of cities increasingly.
Brahms Sieben, despite the in addition to the $8 a gallon gasoline, why do people in Amsterdam care, or do they, or is it a hard sell?
No, I think they do care, but it starts at a different level. So it starts with a question or with a challenge that they face or that they have or something they wish for. And then the technology comes in. So then the technology will help you, I think, to improve, to go a step further. But there are tons of reasons for, and it's difficult to point out there's just one reason or one standard or whatsoever for a consumer. It's if there's a benefit, why not?
You're in the business of selling these smart meters to electric companies and gas companies and water companies, and out in the business of selling them the software that also makes them smart. Is that difficult? Do companies care?
Companies do care. I mean, there is an actively growing market. And I want to point, you know, a lot of this conversation has been about North America. We've talked about Amsterdam, but I want to point out a couple of other examples, Mumbai and Delhi, where we're saving over 300 million liters of water a day by measuring and monitoring the water system for the first time. Places in Africa where electrification rates are quite low because usage isn't monitored. Places in the Middle East in which desalinated water is being wasted on the ground. In areas where there's scarcity, where there's rapid growth, this type of technology is absolutely critical for expanding access to clean, potable water and to electricity and gas.
We talk about, when we talk about sustainability on this program, we talk a lot about energy usage and energy conservation and things like that, air control, air quality, but water is really going to be the big bugaboo in this coming century. We're already seeing it in California. They have 1 year of water left in California. How can this technology alleviate some of our water problems that we're facing not just here but around the world particularly?
Well, miraculously, there are still places in California where residential users don't have water meters. So the first thing we have to do is measure something so we can manage it.
Yeah.
And then once we're able to manage it, then we're able to, first of all, inform the consumer about what's going on and then establish fair pricing structures that send the price signals to those consumers to encourage conservation.
Dan Klotfelter, you've been in government. Yeah, I know you're an attorney by trade, but you've been in government for a long time as a state senator and now as the mayor of Charlotte. Are most politicians and policymakers on board with this? Do they understand it? Do they appreciate the need for it? Is there any political will to help support what it will cost to move toward this technology in many different sectors.
I think there's a growing appreciation of it. Mike, it's never exactly where you want it to be, so there's an awful lot of education work still to be done, but especially locally, I find a wide acceptance of it in local government and real support for implementation.
You see it in the legislature?
In the legislature, it's not as prominent an issue, but
why?
Taking your issue of water, for example, I think there have been some very far-sighted changes in state policy on water utilization, on smart usage of water, and a realization after the droughts we experienced in the earlier part of the last decade and then the later part, the second half of the last decade, that was a wake-up call for an awful lot of state policymakers.
Is it not as top of mind in Raleigh because of the rural nature of much of the state?
Well, it's just because you're managing a much, much larger organization and conditions right. vary so widely across the state. But in large parts of our state, again, water is going to be the leading issue, and I'm glad you called that out. I think it's going to be the thing that's going to be the wake-up call for our state leaders.
What are some of the best practices that you've seen around the world? Maybe you can start in Charlotte if you want to, but we're not that egotistic. Around the world, what are some of the best practices that you're seeing?
I think one of the key things is, I want cities to think about multi-purpose, number one. I also want them to think about these cross-cutting task forces. Just get people in the room talking about what they want to do and how they can share costs and share infrastructure. And then there's things like citywide policy. So have a citywide data privacy policy. Have a citywide cybersecurity policy. Don't ask every department to become a cybersecurity expert. And have a citywide data management architecture so your applications can talk to each other. And so it's those kinds of things.
How long does it take to build something like that out, to make that happen?
Well, it's a journey. Mm-hmm. And, I think in a year you can have the basics put together and so in an action plan. And then you'll be working on it for the next 30.
I have 30 seconds. You seem to be way ahead of us in Amsterdam. So tell me what economic benefits or what benefits you've seen in 30 seconds.
Well, what I think is the benefit, and I think that's great work what the Smart Cities Council is doing as well, is collaborate and act. And you can start in a very small point already and just show people that it actually work, share the learnings out of it, and do so with different cities in all around the world. We'll be doing it on the 1st of June in D.C. as well.
Okay.
That's together with NIST. It's fascinating to learn from others and replicate it.
Let me stop you there. Bram Sieben is a consultant with Alliander in the Amsterdam Smart Cities Program. Philip Meese, President and CEO of Itron. Jesse Burst, Founder and Chairman of the Smart Cities Council. And Dan Klodfelter, the Mayor of Charlotte. Thanks for the hour.